Welcome to the Surviving Grief Podcast, hosted by our grief ministry leaders at Crossroads Church. We'll be sitting down with friends as they share their powerful stories of loss and healing, and we'll hear from grief professionals and other wise people with useful tools for our own time of grief. If you're supporting someone who's grieving, you'll learn how to comfort them and walk with them on their own path to healing. Let's join the conversation.
I'm Jenna.
I'm Nate. Husband of Jenna.
So our journey, I came to know the Lord, my relationship with Jesus in high school. That's really when it kind of became a very personal thing for me. Nate kind of grew up that way. And so we were fortunate when we met and we were dating that this was something that we very much prioritized in our relationship, was a big part of our relationship. And then subsequently our marriage, as we kind of walked into that. Not that it wasn't without major learning curves and, you know, experiences and adventures there. But we knew that kids were always going to be in the picture for us. At least that was a given. I mean, at least at that point in time, when anybody gets married, they're like, well, yeah, like if kids are on the radar, then yeah, we get married, maybe be married for a few years and you have kids. Like it was just kind of a thing of, you know, this is what we were expecting. So we got married young, so knowing we were going to be moving around, we kind of backburnered it a little bit. Like, okay, we'll just enjoy being married for a few years. And then when we came back to Cincinnati, as Nate said, we kind of, that's when things really kind of went to the forefront. And, you know, I had walked several of my close friends growing up and in college had started their families and, you know, walked through all sorts of just what that looks like with them. But, you know, you kind of don't really, it doesn't become a personal thing till it becomes your story. And so, yeah, we started trying, and unfortunately, very quickly learned it was not going to be the quick light switch flip that we were hoping it would be, or at least expecting. Honestly, I was kind of just caught off guard. I didn't think that, I never really had any problems like in that area that I was expecting, you know, no medical diagnosis or anything like that. So when we just kept trying, and it was okay, 3 months have gone past, 6 months have gone past, a year has gone past, and then all of a sudden the dialogue changed with the doctor of, well, you know, maybe you should go seek out a fertility doctor. Maybe there are some questions here that I don't have the answers to. And so that kind of set off a whole different course of events for us, because no longer was I just, well, maybe it's just taking a little longer. Maybe I'm just kind of the anomaly that's closer to a year to get pregnant versus 3 months or whatever the most recent statistic is. It was all of a sudden, oh no, I'm different. Something's weird.
You know, I don't think my parents or her parents, even if they did struggle with it, they didn't talk about it. So like we didn't know anybody that had a trouble having kids. We just thought it was a given. So I think if you're not in that world of like people with infertility or struggling or miscarriage, that like it's just, you don't think about it. Like it's not a part of your everyday conversation or things that people struggle with and talk about. So I think when we encountered that, it was very like, oh, we didn't expect that, or we don't have any experience in this, or we don't even know what to do, because it was just not a part of things people talked about or stories we had heard before. So it was very like, oh, this is a thing, and there actually is a lot of people that struggle with this, but nobody talks about it. So it was pretty weird to uncover like a whole subculture of this going on.
Yeah, 100%. I think that was something that even walking through the doors of our fertility clinic, we go to a local one here in Cincinnati, and like, I mean, as strange as it sounds, just seeing a couple other people sitting in a waiting room, like, oh my gosh, thank goodness I'm not the only one. Because it can be such an incredibly isolating feeling when you're kind of walking this road that nobody really wants to be walking on. So anyways, this was, fast forward a little bit, we were literally just about to pursue treatment going to be starting IUI, which is intrauterine insemination. So the unglorious term is the turkey-baster method, which is terrible, but that's essentially what it is, whether we want to call it that or not. It really kind of sucks any of the romance out of it. But anyways, we were grateful. I mean, we were grateful that there were other options at play. The clinic that we go to is amazing. I mean, we just were so fortunate that I felt like, okay, I was wrestling with God of like, man, am I kind of taking him out of this equation a little bit? Like, am I not being patient enough to trust on him and blah, blah, blah. It was a reckoning kind of like, okay, am I kind of quote unquote playing God here? Or am I just kind of forcing things? And I feel like over time, God very lovingly kind of revealed to us of like, no, if anything, I've equipped this doctor and the staff in this office with the skill set and the ability. And, you know, we live in modern day. I mean, I'm so grateful for modern medicine for a variety of reasons, like leverage these tools and these resources and these gifts that people have. Like you're like, I work alongside and with them. This isn't you taking me out of the equation and just trying to take control yourself. So we were literally just about to start treatment. And then it was actually our wedding anniversary. I was late and I took a pregnancy test and it was positive. So I had the pleasure. We actually were volunteering for Kids Club that morning here in Cincinnati, plug for Kids Club. And so I had to wait to tell Nate because we were literally rushing out the door. I'm like, this isn't the time. So I kept it secret the entire service. We were volunteering and then we went out to lunch. We did a picnic. And so I was able to tell Nate that I was pregnant. And that was the start of the story of our son, Jack. And, it was amazing. I mean, not only was it on our anniversary, I mean, it was like, oh man, God's writing this awesome story. Like, how cool. Like, he didn't need to add that little detail of finding, like, you know, that's just how God works. And so, you know, it was, and we were just about to start treatment, but we were just fortunate to conceive naturally. And, you know, it just felt like all of a sudden it's like, okay, everything's falling into place. This feels good. This feels right. Here we go. And thankfully, for the most part, it was a pretty seamless pregnancy. You know, I think Nate can maybe speak differently, but I felt pretty good. I felt like I enjoyed being pregnant. You know, I think when you're striving for that long, it can just kind of feel like, oh, this is very special. And we decided to do at the anatomy scan, find out the gender. So we found out it was a boy. And so we quickly, Jack was like our number one name, which Nate's family is very into the meaning of names, that not only do we pick certain names because we like them, but every family member in his family knows the meaning of their name.
I'm God's gift.
Nathan does mean God's gift. So
God's gift.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, we just liked that.
And Jack means God is gracious.
Yeah. Yeah. So we were like, man, this is just feeding into that story. We love it. And so we knew pretty quickly that Jack was going to be his name. We didn't share that with people. We kind of wanted to wait till he was born. But we kind of, both of us knew Jack was going to be the strong contender. So, so fast forward, seamless pregnancy. And then close to the tail end of my pregnancy, I was 38 weeks along. So this was, I was due, my due date was technically May 5th. So this was like middle of April that we're in 2018. And I noticed on that an afternoon that I was like, man, I don't feel like I've felt him move as much as I have. Like, usually, like there was definitely decreased movements, but you know, it was my first pregnancy. I didn't really, I tried not to get too upset about it or nervous about it, especially they start getting so big that, you know, there can be at times, at least I've heard, you know, decreased movement. And I had an appointment the next day. And so I went in, we went into the appointment. They did kind of the Doppler sonar heartbeat check and found, you know, a heartbeat. The ultrasound tech was already gone for the day, but the doctor didn't really express much concern over it. So I was like, okay. And then, but she was a little concerned about the placement of Jack. She thought maybe he was breached. And so she just was like, let's get an ultrasound on the calendar for next week. I just want to double check his placement to ensure that we're like set up well for delivery and, you know, potentially explore C-section or whatever it might be if he is breached. So, you know, we kind of went on with it. Again, I kind of was noticing decreased movement, but, you know, was confident that in finding his heartbeat, and the doctor hadn't expressed much concern, that we were kind of moving along. And then fast forward, you know, a couple days later when we had our scheduled ultrasound to check placement, you know, we go into the ultrasound room and then we come to find out that he no longer had a heartbeat. And so that obviously smacked us beside the face, because it was, oh, I'm going in to check out the placement of my baby, and this is the last time I get to see him before I get to hold him and see his face for the first time, and just all the things that come with prepping to meet your kiddo and bring him into the world. And, you know, all of a sudden the tech just looks at me and is like, oh, I'm so sorry, I can't find a heartbeat. And it's like, oh man, it just takes me right back to that room and that whole experience. So yeah,
and I think for me it was this weird, surreal, like everything, as Jenna mentioned, was like really ordained up to that point. At least it felt that way. So it's like, oh, like right before we took treatment, we found out we were pregnant. Like we didn't have to go through a lot of that. Oh, it was on our wedding anniversary. Oh, a bunch of her friends, which you didn't mention, were also pregnant around like the same time. So we had We had four or five friends that were on kind of the same timing. There's like pictures of them all together pregnant.
Yes.
I have a nephew who was born a week after. So it was just like this very like, I never was worried about miscarriage because I was like, the God I know wouldn't set this all up perfectly for us to just miscarry or whatever. So like I never had fear during the pregnancy because it just felt like God's hand was on this. So I think that was the real like rock for me, like oh my gosh, like is like you set this all up and then you took it from us. So there's this very like, are you the God I have known my whole life?
Yes.
What's going on here? So I think that was like why it was so shocking.
Oh yeah.
Particularly because you pair it with takes forever to get pregnant. We want to have a family. We think we'd be good parents. Special cases happen, then all of a sudden it's all stripped away. So it was very like unlike the character of God that I thought I knew. And I think that's what I struggled with the most initially, and frankly, probably still today.
Oh, yeah. So that was really kind of the start of our grief journey. And then like processing all that, the heaviness of that grief and that loss, but then kind of I'm holding that in one hand. And then in the other hand, I'm holding continuing to fight to grow my family because I felt like God had not closed the door on growing our family. And so we were like, okay, let's, you know, we took the time to grieve and process and, you know, we'll talk more about kind of that extended grief journey, but simultaneously and kind of in the wake of everything with Jack, we also were kind of then starting to take steps towards to continue to grow our family and have more children. And I felt like we were like gluttons for punishment at that point because it was like, oh my gosh, do we even have the emotional, physical, spiritual, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like the
bandwidth.
Yeah, bandwidth to even do this. Like, are we gearing ourselves up again for? I mean, it was an exercise of faith 100%. And then, you know, 38 weeks of waiting or, you know, 40 weeks of waiting again. It just felt like a very, like, I was at the very bottom of a mountain that I'm looking up. I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't even see the top of this, but I feel compelled to keep walking. And so we, a couple years later, again, trying to pursue to grow our family. And I had gotten some surgery just to kind of, I had some endometriosis at play. And so I had a surgery for that. And so the doctor was like, yeah, I think in, you know, 3 to 4 months, I'm pretty confident that you'll conceive again, which, you know, you hold that loosely. You don't want to like bank on all of that. But at the same time, it was nice to at least hear that hope that he felt like it was good. And sure enough, about a month later, I get a positive pregnancy test. And I'm like, well, this is great, blah, blah, blah. And then I go in and get blood work because when you're going to a fertility doctor, they kind of don't have you just like a wait and see. They come in, they're like, yep, let's get blood work. Let's confirm it. And so sure enough, blood work confirmed that my levels were high. I was, in fact, pregnant. And then they have you go in 2 days later to ensure that that blood work continues to increase in the way that it needs to. And I got the phone call that day that your numbers are going down. Sorry. I mean, they were very gracious about it, but it's like, you're likely going to have a miscarriage or you're going to, at this point in time, there's different terminologies based upon the timeline of which you're pregnant. And so this kind of was still falling within the 5 to 6 week timeline of, and so they kind of categorize it what they call a chemical pregnancy, which is just another term for a very early miscarriage. And so here we are, like, what the actual heck is happening? Of like, am I, like, so you start having all these wrestling questions like, God, am I not, like, do you not want us to have children? Is that not in the plan for us? We kind of felt like we were called this way, but that doesn't seem to be like coming to fruition. Like, are we approaching this wrong? Are you like, and then all the additional lies of just like my identity and who I am as a woman, and I'm supposed to be able to like seamlessly bring life into the world. At least, you know, that's what it feels that way. And this is not happening easily. Like, what the heck? This is not happening the way that I need it or wanted to. I just kept feeling like I was failing. And, you know, it's one of those things of not necessarily did I feel like I was like failing God, but I felt like my body was failing me. And I was like, what's going on? And then a couple months after that, we were successful finally in conceiving our daughter, Gracie, who is now, she's now three. So we are incredibly fortunate to have a child here this side of heaven that we get the privilege of raising and seeing grow. And it's been a huge blessing. But there's also this heaviness and weight of that isn't the pretty bow on the package of, okay, that doesn't take away the grief and the loss and what kind of came before it. And, you know, obviously no child after experiencing any form of pregnancy loss is a quote unquote replacement for the child. But like you just start kind of wrestling with all those simultaneous thoughts of I have to learn how to hold both grief and joy simultaneously. And I think that has been something that I've started to learn and I'm still continuing to learn.
Yeah, and with our daughter, Grace, one of the things I told myself to make myself feel better after Jack was, oh, well, maybe, you know, we'll get pregnant in the time frame that, like, we wouldn't have that child if we hadn't lost Jack, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, it took us 2 years or so to get Gracie. So, like, I could have had them both. And so that is also one of those things I have wrestled with of, you know, you justify things in your brain of like, oh, God did this because, you know, I wouldn't have my child, but like the timing doesn't work. So it's just like it layers on top of the frustration of like, why did the Lord allow, you know, Jack to be taken?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a believer that he causes that thing, but I do think he has the power to stop or allow things or not allow things. So that whole process was definitely a test of my relationship with the Lord and how I viewed him and my faith and those type of things.
So I want to take you both back to the doctor's office. Mm. So you just get this news that rocks you individually as a couple, 39 weeks pregnant, 38?
Yeah, I was 38.
38 weeks pregnant. Mm-hmm. So you're in the home stretch.
We
got people who are delivering full-term babies. You're at the end. And so if you're not familiar with the pregnancy world, you still have to deliver this baby. And your body thinks that you have a baby.
Yes.
And so it's not just you left the office and then you start grieving. You have steps that still have to happen that are incredibly painful. So walk me through for each of you. You leave that office and then you still got to go to the hospital and deliver a baby.
Yes.
Tell me about that period for you.
Well, I think it was an incredibly surreal moment because we the ultrasound room was, you know, a stone's throw from our doctor's personal office in our, you know, in the practice at the time. And I'll never forget. It's such a weird, vivid memory of walking into that room and she looks at us and she's like, okay, guys, here's the deal. You have to deliver this baby. And I remember sitting there like, I don't want to. This is going to be very hard. I don't think I'm going to be able to do this. Sorry, it's a very vivid memory just sitting in there. But it was one of those moments where I was like, I mean, it's like the adrenaline takes over and you're just like, okay, like I'm going to have to. And then so God, while you don't want to be in certain positions, God was very merciful in giving us incredibly gracious and impatient people around us, not only in that doctor's office, but then fast forward a little bit in the hospital. And so she was very, very, very kind. And she was like, here's the deal. You guys can either induce or your body is incredible. We'll give God credit where credit's due, is that your body will start to recognize that this baby needs to come out. And so there's a good chance that natural labor could take place. So take it some time. Think about it. It's up to you as to how you want to approach this. So we didn't make a snap judgment decision. We actually went home and we collectively made the decision. We slept on it. Well, I guess our parents came over and kind of really grieved with us that night.
and just were with us. And then we slept on it and really kind of woke up the next morning and prayed about it and had a lot of peace about that we were going to just go the induction route. And so we called them, and then they said, okay, great. Like, you know, come on in that afternoon. So it was the following day. And thankfully, mercifully, my body took well to the induction, and Jack, it wasn't a very long labor and delivery, and Jack came into the world very quickly with one little push, and all of a sudden he was there.
I remember for me, like, after the initial shock, and you're still kind of like in shock, but you don't necessarily recognize that you're in shock. I remember like me jumping into like logistics mode almost, and okay, we're gonna have to figure out how to, it's going to be hard. We're going to have to deliver this baby and all the craziness that comes with that. And frankly, I'm like really worried about Jenna, not just physically, but like the mental health of my wife, you know, paired with infertility and identity issues. And then you lose the baby and it's like, oh my gosh, is she mentally going to be okay? So I feel like I went there. So part of my grieving story is like delayed grieving, mm-hmm. I think. Because I was very concerned about Jenna. And I do remember calling, like, cause I left work to go to the ultrasound where he found out that he didn't have a heartbeat.
Yeah.
And you're like, you don't really know what just happened really. So I'm like called up my boss and I was like, hey, I'm probably gonna stay home today. And maybe I'll come in, you know, tomorrow or something. You know, like I hadn't processed what just happened. Like, yeah. I didn't understand that I was going to be through some pretty serious grieving and not be able to function at work. Like, it just didn't register. I soon figured that out, especially when we went home. Like, I don't think I'm going to be able to deal. I don't know how you're feeling, Jenna. I don't think I'm going to be able to deal with seeing you walk around.
Yeah.
Knowing that Jack's not alive in there. Like I just don't think I can mentally deal with that.
Yeah.
She agreed. So that's why we decided to induce. And then, you know, obviously once you go through that and you see him and you hold him, and then I'm like, oh, this is like not, like, I'm not going to be able to go to work tomorrow.
Yeah.
Like, this is like.
Emails are not a problem right now.
Yeah. This is like, very like life altering all of a sudden. And I don't think that, like, I was very disappointed in the ultrasound room and like shocked, but like, when I held him, I was like, I'm not going to be the same anymore. Like, I don't know what that looks like. I don't know if that's going to be a good or a bad thing. It feels very bad right now. But like, going through this, my life has changed now. And we're going to see, hopefully for the better. But like, at the moment, definitely not.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the two of you made a really brave decision in that moment, in that hospital room at the pinnacle of the pain for you. They offered to take pictures.
They did.
Yeah, so it's this really super awesome organization called Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep, who are just fantastic. They're volunteers. I initially was not interested in taking pictures. I didn't want to remember that moment. But we were advised.
Yes.
I forget by who.
A close friend of ours. She's the one who actually arranged for. She's the one who reached out to the organization and was helping arrange for it.
Yeah.
And she had talked to a close friend who had been through a somewhat similar circumstance.
Yeah. She basically was like, you can always not look at them.
Yep.
But if you want to see them years down the road, like, you're going to wish you had them.
Yeah.
So
you don't want to be in the position to where you would want them and they would not be available.
Correct. So in the moment, it was more of a, we didn't want them, but knowing that hopefully healing would occur and maybe we'd change our minds and we weren't going to be forced to look at them in the future.
Yeah.
That, like, might as well get them. But I will state that the lady who did our pictures was a blessing
she
from
was.
The Lord.
She was an angel. Like, she really was.
She, the way she cared for, and stillbirth, like, that is not a pretty process. The baby is in different state of
there's some
decay.
Physical, yeah. There's some physical.
So it's like, when he first comes out, it's like a baby, but they deteriorate very quickly.
Yes.
So that's very hard to go through that and watch them kind of disappear before your eyes a little bit, like they change before your eyes. But she got in there and she was, you know, helping put clothes on him and positioning him in our arms and things like that. It was just very, like, nothing fazed her and to get those shots. And that was a very subtle but amazing gift that we
got. She didn't shy away from, you know, we didn't get to be the parents that got to be like, look at our newborn. Here's some pictures you want to see. And, you know, our camera rolls, like we couldn't be the doting parents. And for a very split second, we felt like we got to be those parents. And she was, again, God just very mercifully put what I consider to be very specific people in our path during that time. And she was one of them, of just the way she cared for us and how she was present, and she did incredible work and, like, just a skill set on display of, like, man, what an opportunity. It's a unique niche. Who voluntarily signs up to go and be with people in arguably one of their darkest moments in their life and enter into that? Like, that's not just something you wake up and go, yeah, that sounds good. Like, man, those people, it's like the calling that they have to even willingly step into something like that, to provide a gift to families in that way, is absolutely incredible. So yeah, I mean, we didn't look at the pictures much right away, but I can wholeheartedly say I'm very thankful we have them. They kind of catch your breath a little whenever, you know, your iPhones have, like, memories that just randomly pop up on your photos. Like, every once in a while, one of those will come up, and it's a very sweet moment, but also incredibly, like, sucks the breath out of you for a hot second when you're just kind of going about your day, and to see those. And I feel like it was just one of those things that it just cemented the fact that he was our son and he was present. And he was here, because it was such a fleeting moment. Like, it's a very weird space to be in. And I think somebody said it well, of, like, when you get hit with a bomb like that of grief, it truly does feel like a bomb went off. Like, you're walking out of the explosion. You can't fully hear everything. You can't really see much what's going on. Your adrenaline is just pumping because your body's literally just in survival mode. And you're hyper present, but you're also not present at all. It's the strangest word to describe, but I just think anyone who's been through just a bomb in their life like that, they can easily relate. And being in the hospital for that 48 hours that we were in delivering Jack, I can wholeheartedly say that was how it felt. Like, I was in some ways very, very present, and then in other ways I was just in this numbed fog of what does life look like now? And then we're driving home with an empty car seat, of like, okay, what the heck do we do now? What does life look like now in the wake of, I can't go back in time. I can't change anything. My sweet boy's not coming back. I had full confidence that he was just fine. If anything, he was doing much better than I was, but you
skipped out on the worst part.
He really, yeah, did.
He really did.
You know, we just joke around now at this
lucky
point in time that, man, God loved Jack so much, he spared him all the pain and sin and hurt that is in this world and just took him right back up. But that doesn't necessarily obviously take away from just the bomb that went off in our life, and now we're left to kind of figure it out from there.
And so, Nate, you talked about kind of really being focused on Jenna, and, you know, she was still dealing with the physical symptoms of just delivering a baby. And again, it's not that she left the hospital and then, okay, now we can start grieving.
Right,
no.
Right.
Now there's more things, right?
Yes.
Like, with you're pumping, you're,
yes,
not sleeping, you got hormones all over. I mean, you got things going on.
I got all the things going on.
You got all the things going on. And so you talked about delayed grief. Tell me a little bit about what that immediate process looks like, because I think, especially for men in the stillborn, in the miscarriage space, we don't necessarily hear a lot from them. So kind of help walk us through what your journey looked like after you guys left the hospital.
Yeah, I think I would say there was two phases. The first was I had seen, I've seen miracles happen in my life. So like my brother was miraculously healed from cancer. He should be dead. He's not. He was infertile because of the cancer treatment, and he now has 5 kids. So I have seen and witnessed supernatural miracles happen, even in my own family. And so I didn't even, like, even when we found out his heartbeat had stopped mm-hmm. and, like, he was not there, like, I was still praying for a miracle. Like, I thought, like, what a cool story if we go to the hospital to give birth to a stillborn and he comes out and he's alive. Like, God can do miracles. Like, he can. And, like, it didn't happen. Like, I even had, like, this weird sense that I was confident that I kept the car seat in. Like, in our car when we drove to the hospital. I just choked up when I think about that. I kept the car seat in. And he didn't give me the miracle. And so there was that initial, like, I still was holding on to the what sliver of hope that I had. Because I'd seen it in my own family before. So then when it didn't happen, it was kind of like a real, like okay, this is it. Like,
it cemented it.
It cemented it. Yeah. It didn't happen. So I think that it went from like that was like a real low in the hospital when, you know, you're holding. I think we spent, it was like 4 hours with them.
Yeah, roughly. 3-4 hours. Yeah.
And our parents were there. But afterwards, it quickly kicked back in to like, what are we going to do to get past this? How is Jenna mentally? Like, this is the type of stuff that like really screws up marriages. I'm pretty worried about that. This is the type of stuff that make people question their relationship with the Lord. I'm kind of worried about that. So there's that kind of lingering in the back of my brain. But there's also like the straight up, okay, what do you, nobody trains you for like, do I go to a morgue? Like, I don't know what to do. Like,
yes.
Do you have to go to a normal, like, is it viewed as like a normal death and you... You know, we had to go pick out a urn.
Oh, yeah.
Like, so you kind of had to figure that stuff out. And luckily, the hospital kind of helps give you some stuff in that regard.
The day after.
Yeah, the day
we
after.
We delivered our baby.
We.
I'm wearing, you know, that super sexy diaper that they give you postpartum. Like, you know, still physically recovering there. And we're having to go to Spring Grove Cemetery and talk about making arrangements for, you know, cremation. And then they take us back into this horrible, horrible little room of like picking out, it's a horrible room of, and no knock on the cemetery, but you have to go pick out an urn. And it's like, how am I, like, where, it was one of those moments where it's almost so bad it's comical that you're like, it's like, am I being punked right now? Like, I literally went in and saw the first one and was like, that one, because I couldn't even physically be in that room. I was so like angry because I was like, I am literally like wearing my sexy postpartum diaper. I don't have a newborn and I'm picking out an urn. Like, this is just so far from anything of what it was supposed to be. Like, what is actually happening right now? And then poor Nate is trying just to like, he knows I'm at, you know, pretty max capacity in a lot of ways. So he, bless his heart, is, like he said, processing everything as Jack's father, but then also very much needing to do a lot more of just the sheer logistics of things and tying up loose ends. And we had wonderful friends and family that were willing to sit in the trenches and do as much as they possibly could for us. But there's just certain things in that scenario that just you have to do. Like, we had to then start thinking about a memorial service and how to, you know, honor Jack's life. And we were all over the fence with what we wanted to do. I mean, it's just those types of steps that you're like, I am like, this is whiplash right now, but it's so many things happen so quickly right after the bomb goes off that you're like, I don't even have my full mental faculties to do all of this yet.
Yeah. And we did decide to do, it's worth noting, a memorial service, which is a weird concept when you don't.
We didn't have much. Of,
you never knew him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. People didn't know him. We didn't know him as a person. Right. So it's a weird. We decided to do it because we wanted to take the opportunity to thank people for their love and support throughout that entire process. So, yes, it was a little bit of an honoring of Jack's existence, but we didn't know Jack.
Yeah.
So it was a memorial service to say thank you to all the people that helped us, and we are choosing to still honor God in this moment and trust God. One of the verses that has kind of been like one of our, I guess, themes throughout this is Isaiah 61:3, which is about, you know, he's going to ashes for crowns and a garment of praise instead of mourning and oil of gladness, so that you may be called oaks of righteousness, a planting for the Lord for his glory. And so, like, the Lord laid that verse on our hearts pretty early in the process. And we, even though we didn't feel like it, we wanted to be oaks of righteousness for God's glory, not our glory, God's glory. And that was one of the reasons why we decided to do the memorial service was to, even if we didn't feel like it, carry that mission out that we felt like the Lord put on our hearts.
Yes, I would agree with that. And I think what stuck out a lot about this whole, like, what is oaks of right? What does that even mean? You know, as you're kind of thinking through it. And I think something that just stuck out so much was when you think of an oak tree and you think about the roots and how deeply, deeply rooted into the ground they are, that the storms that pass, that tree is still rooted and it is deep and it is there and it continues to grow. And I think that was something that really kind of stuck out to Nate and I of like, okay, this is the true definition of a storm in life. This is arguably, hopefully, one of the biggest storms in our life we're going to have. And we wanted to still feel like we were rooted in God, rooted in each other, rooted in the hope for our future family, rooted in the incredible community that was coming around us and willing to say, look at us and say, we're sitting in this with you. We know not everybody has that when they're going through trauma and grief. And so we were incredibly fortunate, and that was not lost on us. So we had friends look us in the eye and say, listen, we're not shying away from this. You're not hard to be around right now. You're going through something. We're sitting in the trenches with you. So, yeah, I mean, I think it was something that the concept and the view of what is an oak of righteousness look like, I think it was such a tangible, like, physical view of, okay, like, are you who you say you are, God? But also, like, again, you can redeem a lot of this, but we're going to be rooted. We're going to choose to be rooted and stay and be rooted, then let this just completely unravel our entire life.
Nate, you talked about some of the snapshot statistics when it comes to married couples staying together after they've lost a child, and they are frighteningly low. And so part of that is men and women grieve very differently. It's an unbelievable, stressful process, to put it very understated, right?
There's totally fair.
There's so much upheaval to your life. And so even though you both went through this experience, you're processing it very differently. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of couples, it becomes this insurmountable wedge.
Totally.
So what did that look like, forcing the rootedness of grieving together and grieving with God? And were there struggles because you were processing it differently or delayed in your case, Nate?
Yeah, I mean, if you can't tell from the podcast, Jenna is very extroverted and outgoing and processes verbally, and I do not. So forget about even the delayed grieving. I knew I had a tendency to, like, internally process my grief and not talk about it. Like, I do not want to talk about this. Like, I want to listen to music. I want to pray. So I kind of made, I remember telling this to Jenna, like, early on. I remember I looked at her and I said, we have got to, like, talk through this. Mm-hmm. Like, we have to. Like, part of it was me saying it out loud because I knew I was the one who really needed this, right?
Yeah, you don't have to ask me to talk. This, like, is not a...
This is like pumping me up, right, in a commitment of, we need to not stop talking to each other. And I think I said that like the day we got back or something.
I have a very vivid memory of you looking at me straight in the eye. I was like, this is not going to break us. We have to keep talking about this. Like, this will be, and I think it was, yeah, I think to your point, it was a little bit of a, I'm acknowledging I'm going to lean in and probably do something that was
way out of your comfort zone, but also like just kind of, it was a great, like, you leading us in that way of just, I'm putting the stake in the ground and we're going to fight against the temptation to just shove it all down and pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and, you know, just keep on going. Because that's not grief. And it's a weird inclination I think most people have of just, I'm fine. And then they just kind of go, but like, it's okay to not be fine. Like, that's part of it. And so I think that was helpful for me to hear that acknowledgement of like, we're going to talk about this and it's going to be okay if you're not fine, because we're probably not going to be fine for a while.
Yeah, I think it's just for me as a concerted effort to, hey, I'm feeling pretty crummy today. Like, I should tell that to Jenna.
Yeah.
Like, it's simple. Like, it sounds simple, but like, that goes against a lot of my personality, I would say. So I think that helped. Like, I think,
oh, yeah.
I think
it for sure did.
If I wouldn't have decided to do that and kind of go against my nature of like, hey, Jenna, I'm feeling pretty bad today. I really miss Jack. And like, I'm really doubting like that God loves us. Like, that would not be something I would regularly share with somebody, but, or even my own wife, which is weird, but it's true. So I credit making that decision early on as a big help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I will say too, I have no doubt that we just had so many people praying for us.
We did.
It, like, so much of how protected I feel like I felt like our marriage was, mm-hmm. is a direct correlation to the amount of people that were praying for us. Like, it's one of the few times in my life that I feel like I can be like, I can tangibly feel this power of prayer right now. Like, truly.
And yeah, I think it's the first time I have felt that people talk about it. But
yes.
That, like, people say, I was lifted up by your prayers. Like, you don't really. It's the, what does that mean?
Yeah.
We physically felt that.
Yes.
Like, we felt carried, like, we were very weighted, but we felt light because we knew there was an army of people that were praying for us and our marriage.
Yeah, I think about one of my good friends. She always talks about, you know, in scripture in the Old Testament when, you know, Moses has to keep his arms raised to therefore for the army to keep winning. And he gets so exhausted and so tired, he can't hold up his own arms anymore. And so he's got Aaron on one side and her on the other side. And she finally looked at me. She goes, let us be your Aaron and her right now. You don't have to be the one to raise your arms. And, you know, for most people, I can imagine, I don't want to be the one that needs help. I want to be the one that's helping others. I told her, I was like, I don't like being in this position. I like being the helper. I don't like being the helped. But, I mean, this was just the time in our life, and to have a friend look me in the eye and say, it's okay, you need help. And I mean that in the most loving way possible. Let us be those people. Let us be the ones to hold you up. And prayer was one part of that. And it truly, like, even Nate was saying, when he would just be honest about how he was feeling, it was even wild to see on a very detailed level that on days where he was having a harder day, I was having an okay day. It wasn't a good day, but I was having an okay day. And so I could maybe carry us a little bit that day. And then wouldn't you know, the next day or the next wave that came, and it was a hard day for me, Nate was having an okay day. Like, that happened multiple, like, there, I feel like I can't think of many days where we were both just like knocked down flat. And again, I think that's just that's not coincidence. I feel like that was very purposeful and orchestrated in that way of, hey, if you guys, you're going to be faithful to lean into this, I'm going to be faithful to carry you even with some of these small details. And I wanted to just keep pressing fast forward. That's just, I just kept wake every morning. I wake up and be like, oh gosh, like, it was like a rectifying your reality, right, in your brain, because you kind of forget it a little bit when you're sleeping. And thankfully we were able to sleep, and then we'd wake up in the morning and it'd be like your reality would hit you all over again. And it was like, oh, I mean, there's just that wave of weight and grief kind of coming on you. And like, okay, it's like I just had to like get the energy to get out of bed and be like, okay, here I go. And I just remember thinking like, okay, but Nate, while he definitely processes it differently, he's going through, like, he lost a son too, and he's in it with me. Like, it became this level of comfort. And even though we were processing it differently, it didn't become a weapon of me getting angry at him because he isn't processing it the way that I need him to or want him to, or vice versa. You know, and a lot of my issues were more so with identity. As I said earlier, like, you know, we're women, a part of our opportunity and our identity and our biology is the opportunity to bring life into the world. And, you know, while that's not the right fit for every single person, it still feels like part of like, well, I should be able to do this. I this should be no problem for me. And I mean, even in the wake of everything with Jack, it's even evident if you look in the Old Testament, the amount of women that have struggled conceiving is insane. And they're direct women in the direct line of Jesus. I mean, I think about like, it's one of the first stories of the first couples we hear, like infertility and loss. And I can't even imagine, they don't talk about loss very much in scripture, but I can't imagine that those women who struggled for decades with infertility did not experience loss. It might be a bold statement, but I just imagine that they often go hand in hand. And so infertility and loss is not something new to God. He knows it. He knows it intimately. And so there is also some comfort in knowing that in my personal growth journey, where it was really seeping a lot more into my identity than I would argue maybe Nate's did because of, you know, conceiving and carrying the pregnancy and things like that. Even still to this day, I mean, we're still trying to grow our family. It's still not easy. I wish I could say, oh yeah, it's, you know, we flipped a light switch. It's easy. We have 7 kids now. We don't. But, you know, and it's, I mean, that's still something I wrestle with to this day, that I'll apologize to Nate when another month goes by and it didn't, you know, we don't have the positive test. I'm like, man, Nate, sorry, I got a wonky uterus right now. I mean, and he looks at me and he's like, what are you doing? Like, this isn't your fault, but it's a lie you quickly believe of like, dang, I'm failing over here, you know? And so I feel like that was something that, just to commend Nate, like he was able to recognize that and speak directly into that of my identity. And then hopefully I was able to do the same at times. But
Nate, one of the first times that we met, you shared a really redemptive piece of your story that had to do with a dream. Why I would love for you to share that story is because when you're in the doctor's office and then when you're in the ER and you're delivering a baby and you have the car seat, those are such pain points that it's hard to imagine what the ushering in of hope
totally.
And redemption of our story looks like. And to this day, this is one of the more powerful stories that I've ever heard when it comes to a redemptive piece after a child loss story. So I'd love for you to share that.
Yeah. Sometimes I'm a little hesitant to share because I remember going through, you know, infertility and that Jack's loss. So like, you know, 5-year period. And hearing, you know, I think we do a disservice sometimes like at church or whatever when we get up and we share like the miracle stories. And people who are going in the middle of it, like those stories are very painful for like, it was painful for me. Like, hey, I don't want to hear about your redemptive story because my story is not even close to that right now. So I caveat that with this, but I'll plow through here. So when me and Jenna moved back to Cincinnati, we decided to start our family. And I remember like we had the conversation and we're like, okay, like, let's start trying to figure this out. And before we even, it was probably like 2 days after we agreed to start trying for a family, I had this like crazy vivid dream. It's one of those ones where, and I'm not one for theatrics or God spoke to me type of things, but I remember I woke up from this dream and I literally had tears streaming down my eyes. And Jenna, I'm not a crier.
He's not a crier. I do the crying for both of us.
She does. Tears, because it was so real, and all it was an image of me, and I had a little girl with me, and I had her in my arms, and she had a little yellow dress on, and we were on the back deck of like my brother's at the time, his porch, and all I was doing is I had this little girl in a yellow dress, and I was pointing out to like a forest, and just talking to her, and that was it, that was the dream, but it was so real. That I was like, I just saw a vision. Like, this was a vision, not a dream. This was a vision. Anyway, this was before we even knew we had fertility issues. Mm-hmm. This was prior to Jags, prior to miscarriages, all that stuff. Didn't even know we were going to have trouble having a kid. So when we found out fast forward whatever 2 years so down the road, we found out pregnant with Jack. And I remember even being a little taken aback that the fact that it was a boy, because I had this crazy vision of it being a girl. Anyway, didn't think too much on it. Fast forward, lose Jack. Crazy. I don't think about this dream at all. A couple years later, we do get pregnant with Gracie. We have a little girl. Fantastic. And I remember, like, it was like literally soon thereafter. And this is like a little weird part of the story, but I promise you it's significant. My brother moved. So that vision of being on his back deck was like not going to be a reality, which it kind of made me think when I saw it, because the girl in the vision was a little bit older, maybe 2 or 3 years old. But we had this little tiny baby newborn, so it didn't fit the thing. So I was like, whatever. Anyway, this past Easter, we were over at my in-law's house, and I'm on the back deck at their house, and they have a big woods behind their house. And Gracie comes running up to me, our daughter, and I pick her up, and I'm pointing at some birds, you know, off in the trees. And it freaking hits me like a lead balloon, like, oh my gosh, it happened. Like, my little girl who's 2 and a half in a yellow dress on a deck looking out into the trees. And now the time between that is probably, what, five? Well, it's longer than that, probably 7 years.
Seven-ish years, eight years, maybe.
And so, crazy story, but the reason I think it's interesting is because my story about Jack is about a feeling of God breaking a promise to me. That was my big hurdle, was, hey, you set this all up, you told me you're going to give me a son, and then you took him from me. So I journal, and I'm not a journaler, but I journal once a year at least.
Nailed it.
Or I was journaling more, whatever, on Jack's birthday. And I this past year, I kept looking back at my journal entries about Jack, and there's this common theme in them about, like, hey, I'm still struggling with this idea of broken trust and, like, in the faith, and do I have faith, and you kind of let me down, God, on this whole issue. And just my entry this year was about a kept promise from God, not a broken promise. And just the mind shift change that brought with it about God's in it for the long term. And to be clear, there's still some unresolved issues I have with that, like, because I still, like, I could add them both. But God is a God of redemption. He is a God of, he loves us. He's not about taking stuff from us. He's about giving things to us, giving good things to us. Gracie is a good thing that he gave to us. And so that little vision, that little story, I think is, although it doesn't always put a bow on it, because like I said, I feel like I could have them both. Like, there is that redeeming element of God is a promise keeper. And so that has obviously been very much a part of my how I was before and how I am now is taking that viewpoint.
And when we're in it, when we're in the early stages of grief, we have no idea how redemption is going to look, how it's going to feel in our story. And it takes time.
You talked
about the fast forwarding, and you forced yourself to deal in the moment and to feel the feels and to encourage people into that walk with you, right? You really leaned on community and each other when the tendency, like you said, is to kind of shy away from those things. And you continued to grow and honor his memory by, you know, participating and leading grief groups here and sharing not only the hard things about Jack, but then the good things that have come.
Yes.
And the way that his story and your story has continued to impact people in their own grief journeys.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was something that was really important to us. Like, we didn't have the capacity to do a lot, particularly like the first year or two, to kind of, I think that's a big question that people come up with, like, what do you do around these key markers and dates, and particularly maybe their birthday or anniversary of something or what here? But I know Nate and I really kind of put a stake in the ground of like, we knew the lives that Jack's little life had already impacted. And we're like, even though it was short on this earth, his life had and continues to have incredible impact. And, you know, we didn't want our grief to go into this void. Like, I think there's something in just being able to come alongside other people and say, I know how you're feeling. I know the weight of this. You're not alone. And that's something, grief can be the most isolating thing that someone will ever go through in their life. And it's tragic. And it's probably the biggest thing is that people don't really want to talk about it. I get it. But there really is power in just even coming alongside somebody and not even forcing them to talk like crazy, but just coming. It's an honor. It really is that I don't think anybody signs up to spend their, you know, Tuesday evening talking about the loss of a loved one and how hard it is and the emotions and the questions and all the things that come with it. But it's a sacred space that I'm confident and I've seen firsthand God enters that he even says in scripture that he's in grief with us. He has a lot to say about it. And oftentimes I know for a while I just had to put my hands over my ears because I'm like, but then as I started to kind of lift them off and listen a little bit more and just kind of see what he was doing. And, you know, and then it's the little things too that for his birthday, like we do some sort of service project every year. And we were like, you know what would be cool is not only do we have that tradition for just our immediate family, for future siblings of Jack's, that we wake up and we choose to say that day we are going to bless other people in Jack's name and in God's name. At the same time, that we just didn't want it to be a day that felt like it was in vain and wasted. And by no means is this a prerequisite for anybody else who goes through this. Was something that we made the diligent choice with our family to do. And what was even cooler is that we extend the invite to other family and friends to participate and whatever that looks like. And so it's a very cool opportunity to hopefully demonstrate not only to our kids, but also our friends and our family of like, this can be a day of joy while we also grieve the sweet life that we didn't get to see lived out on the side of heaven. But there's ultimate joy because I have full confidence that because of what Christ did, I'm going to get to meet my son one day, and he is going to have just been fine up in heaven. And so the fact that I can ultimately at the end of the day have that confidence, and I'm so grateful for that. That's where the joy can come from on even the hardest days. So,
for you, Nate, this is a question that we always end with. What does good grief look like to you now?
I think the one of the things I've wrestled with, there's a lot of like almost strategic things about grief that I've learned. You know, grief's not linear. There's waves of grief. It's good to talk it out, talk your emotions out. For me, it's more of my relationship with Jenna, but also with the Lord in what grief is and how I process it. And grief was, I think there's always that question of, since I grew up kind of in the church and following Jesus, like the value of a tested faith. And I think you always want to tell yourself that, hey, I'm going to believe Jesus no matter what happens in my life. And then all of a sudden something real happens and you question that a little bit. And so I think good grief was that idea of, yes, like my relationship with the Lord looked different. And yes, I was angry at God, which ironically was a good sign to me that I was actually angry at him. Like I had a relationship with God in which I could be angry at him and he could take it. And that was okay. So like I never felt like I lost faith on any regard. I was mad. And so like being in a relationship with a God who can take that anger was almost like really cool in how I thought about like, this is part of grieving. Like, and he's okay with that. And the other thing I think of, like, is I'm always reminded of the story of, like, I love, my favorite story in the Bible is probably the story of Abraham and Isaac. And it's a story about God wanting your first fruits and how he provides lamb. And it's just really cool. It's just full of imagery of precursoring and a prophecy to Jesus coming. But even though I didn't do it willingly, I gave God my little first fruits. And to me, that has been a cool, like, I can do this, God. Like, in my relationship with you is very real, and I still love you, and you can pretty much have what you want. I'm still dealing with that with Gracie, like, pretty latched on to her. But I do feel like I can live life a lot more open-handed than I did before, because I've already given him my first fruits, and, like, it was okay. So, to me, that's kind of what good grief looks like.
Jenna, how about for you?
I think I've learned very quickly that there is a difference between holy grief and hurtful wallowing. And I feel like the best way I can describe it is, before everything with Jack, I'm still an eternal optimist and always been that it's fine, everything's fine, I'm fine, everything's fine. And so it was really challenging for me post Jack to be like, I'm not okay. And to be honest about that and to not be like ashamed about that or to not shy away from being honest and about that. But I think where the grieving and wallowing for me kind of came into play is that, like, the best way I've heard it described is like you had a vase and it was shattered. And I feel like wallowing, when you're just caught in this vicious cycle, you're just desperately trying to piece the vase back together so it's exactly the way that it was before it broke. But when something shatters like that, even if you meticulously put every piece back together, it's not the same vase that it was. And so when we spend all this relentless time just trying to get it back to where it was, that's not how it works when you lose somebody, when you lose a loved one, that, you know, God can't redeem it in the fact of, like, bringing that direct person back to exactly who they were prior to the loss. Like, that is unfortunately just not how it works. But we know that God's a redeemer. So when you look at the concept of grief and losing someone, it's like, how does redemption work in this story? Because all I want right now is them back. And that's not a reality. And so I can honestly say now, being kind of a little bit more through the process, definitely not over it, that's not really a thing, I would argue, but, you know, through grief a little bit more, that I've been looking at, okay, God, how can you redeem this, though? Because I've made peace with the fact it's going to be redeemed in other ways than just bringing this person back. And so I think even taking that step through it of, okay, redemption doesn't look like bringing Jack back. And now I have a little, he'd be five, almost six this year, running around my house. That isn't how it works. But how can you redeem part of our story with infertility and Jack's story with loss for your good? And that's where we've just seen, like, story after story after story. And I think that God will continue to build out this story of relationships that we've built with people and how I try to, like, come alongside women that have experienced and are currently experiencing infertility and loss, that, like, yeah, it's not something that's, like, super pretty and super fun to walk into, but it's a necessity. Like, we are doing ourselves a disservice when we don't talk about it. And I think our generation, to Nate's point, we're taking strides in that way so that women don't feel so lonely and isolated. And then Nate stepping in and coming alongside men who are coming alongside their spouses, because it's a different process, but it impacts men. And also simultaneously helping to encourage and educate my friends that haven't experienced infertility and loss. I am so grateful that that is not a road. I do not wish this on anyone. But also, if there's a way that I can help you better understand how to come alongside somebody that is experiencing that, and offer them that gift of companionship and community that's so necessary, but also maybe help keep you from saying some things that would perpetuate the grief and the hurt. That's also something that's really important. So I just feel like there's all these little nuggets that, can I say wholeheartedly, I'm grateful this is our reality and that Jack isn't here? Probably not. And I think that that's okay. But I can honestly say that God is good and that he is redeeming and will continue to Jack's life and then what our life and kind of our story looks like in the wake of that. And then hopefully, like, it will be a testament to our relationship with Gracie and hopefully other future kids of, like, it's going to hopefully make us better parents, that we've become a better spouse to each other, that we've become a better and more compassionate and more empathetic friend, and just all the things that kind of are the little gifts along the way.
Well, Nate, Jenna, thank you so much for sharing your story with us and the journey that you've been on.
Thanks for having us.
Surviving Grief is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio. If you'd like to connect or share your own story, reach out to us at podcasts@crossroads.net. We'll see you next time.